We're continuing our study in the 27th chapter of the book of Acts, chapter 27 and 28, of course, and we'll conclude our study in the book of Acts. And this is somewhat of an exciting period of study in the book because it deals with Paul's journey to Rome. We've noted that he anticipated and planned to go to Rome. Now he is going as a prisoner. I doubt very seriously that at the time that he expressed his desire to go to Rome that he thought he would be going as a prisoner. But nonetheless, we have noted that his prayer was that he would be delivered of the unbelieving Jews in the city of Jerusalem. He called upon those in Rome in Romans chapter 15, beginning in verse 25 through the next several verses, to pray for him to that end, that he would be delivered from the unbelievers in Jerusalem. And we know that when he came to the city of Jerusalem in Acts chapter 21, he was arrested. Acts 22, we've seen that he made his defense before the Jewish people. Acts 23, before the Jewish court. Acts 24, before the corrupt governor Felix. And then in Acts 25, before his successor Festus. And now he has appealed to Rome, to the Roman Caesar. And we have noted in the 26th chapter, he's made his defense before King Agrippa, who has been invited by Festus to help him to write a letter expressing why Paul is a prisoner being sent to Rome. And so now in the 27th chapter, we are reading of that expedition, if we may call it that, his journey to Rome. All right, I want to back up and read beginning in verse 1 of chapter 27. We'll read through just a few verses because the journey of Paul and the description that Luke records for us in this passage moves rather quickly, and so we want to be aware of that. Verse 1, "And when it was determined that we should sail for Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners to a centurion named Julius of the Italian band, and embarking in a ship of Adramidian, which was about to sail into the places on the coast of Asia, we put to sea, Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. The next day we touched at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him leave to go unto his friends and refresh himself. And putting to sea from thence, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed across the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia." Now we'll pause right there, because beginning in verse 6, it begins a second leg of Paul's journey. In this study so far, and this is not working, let me try that. In our study so far, we have talked about how Paul was imprisoned in Jerusalem, moved to Caesarea, was there for a period of time, and now I think the best guesstimate that I could give to the period of imprisonment, beginning in Jerusalem, continuing in Caesarea, the trip as a prisoner to Rome involving the shipwreck and the layovers, as we sometimes may refer to them, and all of that together, we want to note that the apostle was imprisoned in Rome, perhaps even as much as 2 years before he could travel then, or before he could be released to pursue his efforts in preaching. Now, that would be a total of something in the neighborhood of 5 years. If you can imagine being a prisoner for that lengthy period of time and no formal charges even brought against you. So this is what Paul was enduring. And we want to think on that soberly. So he's on his way now to the city of Rome. We've been introduced in verse 1 to Julius of the Augustan band. We've noted that he's a very important man, obviously, as we read in this text, a centurion in charge of 100 soldiers. We also might want to note just here that he's very kind in his treatment toward Paul, as when they stop at Sidon, he's treated kindly and given leave to go to his friends.
to refresh himself. In our study, in our last study, I'm not particularly interested in discussing the Italian band or the Augustan band all that extensively. You can do that research on your own and look that up in an encyclopedia. We know that there were different legions of Roman soldiers, depending on where they were and often where they were stationed. And so they became known by some of these particular names. And that's about all I think of as far as the substance of it is concerned that I'm interested in for the purposes of our study. But this band of soldiers and these prisoners, they leave Caesarea traveling north to Sidon. Keep in mind now as we look at the map that where they're going. They're on their way to Asia, and they're going up the coast here of the land of Palestine, Canaan, and then here's Sidon here about 27 miles away. It's not all that far, but we know that the travel was somewhat difficult during this particular period. Oh, okay. We simply want to know where these places are. At any rate, we know that Paul and the other prisoners are delivered to Julius, who is a centurion. We see that in this text.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning? It's good to have you in our Bible class. In our study this morning, we're studying from Acts chapter 27. And beginning to examine the early verses of that context. In verse 4 of our text, it says, "And putting to sea from thence, we sailed under the lee of Cyprus." Now, I've got that labeled on our map here because I think we mentioned this in our last study, and there are a lot of nautical terms that are used in chapter 27, 28 that some of you, no doubt, are more familiar with than I am. Some of you have been in the military, some of you have served in the Navy, and you're very well familiar with some of these expressions that we find here in these two chapters of the book of Acts. But to sail under the lee of a city of a particular piece of land, in this case an island, what was the purpose of that? Get away from the wind, very simply. Yeah.
If you sail on the windward side, which means that the wind is coming right at you, it means you have to tack back and forth in order to get up there. Whereas you're on the leeward side, in other words, the wind's coming from sort of behind you.
Okay. Okay. Now that's from your experience in the Navy.
I threw up a lot in the Navy.
Yeah, okay. All right. So the winds can make travel on the sea, and in particular the Mediterranean Sea is what we're talking about here. Very, very difficult, especially during this particular time of the year. And the time of the year that we have labeled on our map is likely the fall of AD 60. Now the reason why that's so relevant in our study is the October, November was the winding down of the period of time that you could travel on the Mediterranean Sea safely. And this tells us that Paul is in the beginning of the winding down period of travel on the Mediterranean Sea. During the winter months, folks didn't travel on the Mediterranean Sea. It was very, very tempestuous. So they did not travel on the Mediterranean Sea during these most difficult times. At least not this kind of an excursion that would expose them to these storms and tempestuous winds. I understand that were typical of that part of the country. Now, having said that, we want to note that how many people are on board. In this text, you'll note beginning at verse 4, it says, "And putting to sea from thence, we sailed unto the lee of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. And when they had sailed across the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia." Now here's Lycia, the province, as it were, and here is the city of Myra. And so they're sailing to be protected from the wind in that direction. Interestingly enough, we find out later on in the text that these ships that they were on board were not like taking a Caribbean cruise. These ships were merchant ships, cargo ships, as it were. And we note later on the second ship that they're traveling on was laden with wheat. And I understand that that was pretty common during that era of time for the folks in Italy and other places, Asia and Italy, to get their wheat from places like Egypt and across the Mediterranean Sea. So that was not an uncommon practice to travel with that kind of cargo. So if you're going to go from point A to point B on the Mediterranean Sea, you wouldn't find a cruise liner. What you would find is a cargo ship, and try to book travel on that cargo ship. Now, one of the things that we want to note here is, here's a centurion who is responsible, obviously, for prisoners. How many of the people that were on that ship were simply trying to get from point A to point B that were not prisoners, simply trying to book travel? I don't know. But we do know that at least some of them were prisoners, because we've got a Roman soldier that's responsible for their transport, including Paul. Now, another question is raised regarding those who are traveling with Paul. Now, we know that as we have studied so far in our study of the book of Acts, we've noticed expressions like we, us, and them, and they. And by those expressions, we've pretty well been able to track when Luke is along as the author of the book and when he is not alone. When Paul is traveling alone, or left at a particular place, and Luke and those in the company with him go somewhere else. But at this particular point, we know that Luke is on board the ship. Now, I read some material this morning that I thought was interesting, where some were trying to speculate why Luke was alone. Well, we've noted that Luke was alone in Paul's company a number of times, and we know also that Luke was an inspired teacher, because we have the Gospel of Luke, and he's the writer of this epistle. One of the things that we do know about his occupation is he was a physician. We've talked about that a number of times. Those who would speculate, well, why was Luke alone? It's beside the point. Some have said, well, did he pay fare? I don't have the slightest idea whether he paid fare or not. I don't know whether you could prove that one way or the other. Sometimes I understand that from the historical perspective, some of the shipmasters would welcome somebody on board that was a doctor. And so Luke was, and we can certainly see the relevance of having a doctor on board a ship, of this many people being on board the ship. Anything can happen, and so that they might have given him free fare. I don't know. I'm not interested in taking up our time discussing that. Others have wondered, well, why was Aristarchus alone? I don't know why Aristarchus was alone. We know from other passages that Aristarchus is referred to as a fellow worker. We also know that he is referred to as a fellow prisoner. So I don't know if he's arrested and caught up in all of this that's involving Paul or not. That too involves a great deal of speculation. All we know from the text is he's there. He's there. And he's a great help, no doubt, to Paul, as well as is Luke. Now, noting in verse 5, once again, it said, "And when we had sailed across the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia." Myra is about 2.5 miles from the coast of the province of Lycia, I understand. But beginning verse 6, we want to note there let's go to the next chart. What I want to note here is that verse 6 kind of begins a second segment of the journey of the Apostle Paul on his way to Rome. Look at your Bible, if you will, at verse 6. It says, "And there was a centurion," the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing for Italy, and he put us therein. "And when we had sailed slowly many days, and were come with difficulty over against Cnidus, the wind not further suffering us, we sailed under the lee of Crete over against Salmone, and with difficulty coasting along it, we came unto a certain place called Fair Havens, nigh whereunto was the city of Lycia." Now, we want to note some things about this. We've tried to depict on this map where Paul is traveling and why. Here's the journey. And he comes down here again to sail under this island of Crete. Yes, Richard and then Carolyn.
Now notice that we are now on the south side of Crete, whereas we were before on the north side of Cyprus.
Yes.
So the wind has shifted direction. And that's how they're able to get from Nidus to Crete with some difficulty, is because now the wind was pushing them in that direction.
That is correct.
And we'll find that to be a problem later.
That is very much correct, yes.
On your last slide, you noted that there were 276 people on board, but that's the first leg of the journey.
Yes, I think 276 were on the second leg of the journey. Yeah, I noticed that too. 276 were on the second leg of the journey. I don't know how many were on board this particular ship, but that's right. And so, good observation. But what we want to note is where he is, and Richard, your point regarding the winds becomes very relevant. This time of year, the winds could come from any direction. And the most tempestuous winds, we know, often would come from this direction, from what I understand. And sometimes associated with storms, dark clouds, rains, and just all kinds of ugly stuff going on, which tells us, as you've pointed out, why we're on this side of the Isle of Crete. And that itself becomes a very significant point. So we want to note, as we continue reading here, that in verse 8, with great difficulty they came along and found this place called Fair Havens, nigh unto the city of Lycia. Now, Fair Havens, I don't know, did I put that on? Yes, I put that on this map. Fair Havens, I've got that noted here, and we see over on this end of the Isle of Crete, or we're going to see, a place called Phoenix. At least that's how it appears in the American Standard Translation. Other translations, I think, may spell it just a little bit different. But I want to note the time, because we've mentioned the time of this travel was in the fall. And why that was so difficult? Well, how do we know that it was in the fall? Well, verse 9 tells us. It tells us, and when much time was spent, and the voyage was now dangerous because the fast was now already gone by. Paul admonished them and said unto them, "Sirs, I perceive that the journey will be with injury and much loss, not only of the lading and the ship, but also of our lives." Now, in verse 9, it tells us the time of the year. It tells us that the time of the fast was now already gone by. What fast? The Day of Atonement. Yes, the Day of Atonement. Now, interestingly enough, if you turn back to Leviticus chapter 16 and Leviticus chapter 23, the great Day of Atonement, the time was identified by Moses specifically when this was to be. And that would be during the time of October on into September, depending on how the calendar ran. But it was identified as the 10th day of a certain month, which would be the equivalent of our September-October bridge between those times. So it tells us the time of the year that Paul's trying to travel this, or that this centurion is trying to take him to Rome. Some of the most tempestuous times of the year were from October on until about the middle of March. And so now here we are in October, September-October, the beginning of that difficult period of travel. So you can see why that Paul is concerned about the travel. Now, notice, if you will, that Paul warned them that there is danger to come. Now, those of you that have been in our authority class and in previous Acts classes, I want to pick your brain just a little bit. Many of the things that we have noted in our study, in particular in the Acts class, we put them on a timeline. And those of you in our authority class know that as we have studied the travels of Paul in regard to the benevolent work that was to be done in the city of Jerusalem, he addressed that to the brethren in Corinth in 1 Corinthians chapter 16. Now stay with me. Where was Paul when he wrote the First Corinthian letter? He was in Ephesus. That's right.
He traveled on up to Troas. We're going to talk more about that in the Bible and the sermon period this morning. He traveled on up to Troas, hoping to get good news from Titus regarding that First Corinthian letter. He did not meet with Titus in Troas. He was concerned. He went on then into Macedonia, where he did meet up with Titus in Macedonia on his way to Corinth. Now, in Macedonia, having received some good reports, we'll talk about that later, from Titus regarding the church in Corinth, the Apostle Paul makes some mention of the things that he has suffered for the cause of Christ. And you'll read that in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, beginning in verse 23. Now, I want to call your attention to that passage in particular because I want to note one particular item that he mentions in his perils. If you'll turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, beginning in verse 23. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 23. Everybody there? He says, "Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as one beside himself. I more in labors more abundantly, in prisons more abundantly, in stripes above measure, in deaths oft. Of the Jews, 5 times received I 40 stripes, save one. Thrice was I beaten with rods. Once was I stoned. Thrice I suffered shipwreck." Look at that. "Thrice I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day have I been in the deep. In journeyings often, in perils of rivers, in perils of robbers, in perils from my countrymen, in perils from the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in labor and travail, in watchings often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. Besides those things that are without, there is that which presseth upon me daily, anxiety for all the churches." Now, I tried to pause and note that Paul had suffered perils in the sea. But I also wanted to emphasize that he had suffered shipwreck a night and a day. He said, "I had been in the deep." Paul knew what it was to travel on tempestuous seas. Paul is not speculating when he's speaking to this centurion about what's likely to happen during travel on these seas during this time of year. Paul is very well experienced. In fact, now I'll put it on the timeline once again. As Paul is writing these in Corinth in the third preaching tour, and he mentions these perils. And one of them, as we noted, is a shipwreck, night and a day he had spent in the deep. That precedes the events that we're talking about here in Acts chapter 27. Paul had not arrived in Jerusalem where he was arrested and made his defenses before the people and before the Jewish court and all of that, as we have identified in the chain of events. So as he writes those in Corinth, he already knows about what it is to have a shipwreck. He already knows what it is to experience bad weather traveling the Mediterranean Sea. He knows all about that. And so when he speaks to this centurion about traveling during this time of the year, he's speaking from his own experience. And we need to note that. His knowledge may not be as vast as the shipmaster, may not be as vast as somebody who that was their line of work, but he knows what it is to travel on the Mediterranean Sea, and he knows what the season of travel is, and he knows how bad it can get. He's been there, done that, as we would say, got the T-shirt. Randy?
On the other hand, in defense of the centurion, he was charged with getting his prisoners, of whom Paul was just one, to Rome as reasonably expeditiously as he could. He was not charged with taking a vacation. And so if he had Paul on the one hand saying, "It's not a good idea to keep going in here," but yet the harbor master and the captain were saying, "You don't want to stay here. In fact, this is not a good place to spend the winter," then it's understandable that the centurion would say, we'll press on and take our chances.
It is understandable, unwise, but understandable. He's under commission to get the prisoners there. That's right.
And beyond that, the captain of the ship, he's got a load of wheat. He wants to make money.
Well, that's true too. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons to press on. But Paul's concerned about their safety. And these are things that he knows, as he expresses here, from his previous experience. He knows what it is to travel during this time of the year. Now, an interesting thing, and to the centurions and shipmaster and the harbor master's credit, Fair Havens, as we've noted, is not the best place to winter. Over here at, Phoenix, thank you. Over here at Phoenix, my understanding is, and from what I have read about some the modern thoughts of where this harbor was, earthquakes from first century times till present have occurred and changed the landscape somewhat dramatically. But from what I understand, there was a jet of land that came out here and a jet of land that came out here, and the harbor was somewhat in here. And so it was a much better place to spend the winter than it would be here at Fair Havens. Now, let me ask you, you know, we're not shipmasters and we're not experienced seamen and that kind of thing, but if you had your choice to spend the winter at a place that was less desirable, and here's a great big harbor over here that's prepared for ships to stay for several months, perhaps it would be your desire to try to get to that place. If you thought, now we're on the beginning of the bad season, we might find some fair weather days. And we're looking at a place that's only about 40 miles away. Surely we could go 40 miles. And we're going to be traveling on the leeward side of this island of Crete. And so, as you said, Randy, to be fair to the centurion, there is some reason to think in that direction. We've got experienced seamen, the shipmaster and so forth, the harbor master and the ship's owner, saying, let's go forward. And it's your responsibility to press forward. We've got dates to deliver the cargo and all that kind of thing. We can surely make 40 miles and be ahead of the storm, and we'll wait it out there. But you know, sometimes our reasoning is not always sound.
I'm not an expert sailor, but we did have a boat. My grandpa was a fisherman, so I've been around a little bit, read the book my dad loved 2 years before the mass, full of navigational stuff. And in the early days of California, part of the account is if they were harbored and a big storm came in certain places on the California coast, they were safer to go back out into deep waters than to get bashed against the shore.
Yeah.
So I'm curious if that was the situation here, if it was more dangerous to be close in and risk getting bashed against the rocks or whatever. Then, like you said, to go to a safer place and hope that you would get there in some place that's actually safe.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we do know, and this is kind of a shot in the dark, we see them say, and Richard pointed this out, sailing here, the winds were different from what they were sailing here.
That
is right. This is where the storms came from during this time of year, and we see that that became the problem. We've got these winds that were coming from this direction, and we don't know where they wound up. I've seen maps before that just showed a jagged line to represent. We don't know where they wound up out here, but we do know that they were shipwrecked on this island over here because that's specifically mentioned. But if you're traveling along here, you know that this time of year the wind comes from that direction. So typically, doesn't mean there isn't an exception, typically, you would think that if you're on this side of the island of Crete, you're protected. And this is Paul's reasoning. We're safe. We're here. Let's winter here. It may not be the most desirable place to winter as far as amenities are concerned, but at least we have a harbor. Maybe it is better over there. Nicer harbor, more amenities and all that, where most folks would park their ships for the winter. But we don't know. We've got that element. We just don't know. We've got 40 miles. Now, again, I have no experience traveling on the sea. Never been on the sea before in my life. Not even in a little boat. Well, I was in a harbor once, but that's not exactly the same. But the point being here is they're traveling the Mediterranean Sea, which is known to be very tempestuous during this time of year, very dangerous. And so there is some benefits to getting to the better harbor, but it is with great risk because we don't know what the winds are going to do, how they're going to change. In this particular part of the country, I understand it can happen very quickly. Now, my experience has been more in the mountains when I go up in the mountains to go fishing. And I know when a cloud comes in, what appears to be just a real small cloud can just within a couple of hours turn into a snowstorm in the mountains. And some of you well know that. So what we're talking about are things that are peculiar to certain areas of the country and certain topographical areas of the world. And unless you're from there, you probably wouldn't know that. But here are men that are experienced with this kind of thing on this sea. And I find it interesting. We talk about taking a vote. If you'll note in verse 12, it says, "And because the haven was not commodious to winter in, the more part advised to put to sea from thence." What have they done? They took a vote, essentially. And who won? Well, the majority voted, let's go. Let's try to get to the better port, the better harbor, and spend our time over the winter there. Well, so that's what they do. It says, if by any means they could reach Phoenix and winter there, which is a haven of Crete, looking northeast and southeast. Now, that's interesting. Some scholars have had great difficulty with the way that Luke expresses it, as he says, looking northeast and southeast. From what I understand, and we mentioned this a moment ago, that the landscape has somewhat changed over the years because of earthquakes and that sort of thing, but the harbor was here, and it could very well look southeast and northeast as it was originally, which would provide them a safe harbor to winter in. The problem is getting there. The risk is to get there. And so Paul's very much concerned about that. Now, any questions or comments just here?
There's probably a reason why, but mine says it faces southwest.
Yeah.
West.
Yeah. Well, I have a footnote. Southwest wind and down northwest wind. So, the point, I think, being established is that we've got a harbor here that would protect them from these kind of winds. If they parked on this side or if they parked on that side, they'd still have a harbor that would protect them from the tempestuous winds. Now, the problem with that is you don't know when these winds are going to stir up, when the storms are going to come. But this one evidently came rather quickly. If you look at verse 13, "And when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore." All right, what do you have? You've got a south wind. And what's it doing? You're sailing across here very close to the shore. You would think we're protected. We're going to make it.
South wind comes out of the south.
Out of the south. All right, let's do it that way then. Point being is, we're going to make it. The harbor would be just right here. We're going to make it. But this south wind that blew softly, what did it turn into? Yeah. And what is that? A tempestuous wind. From the north. And what did it do to them? All right, they're out here now. Now, there's things that can be said about almost or close that just don't work. They've come awful close to where they want to go. But this tempestuous wind is not allowing them to go north. It's not going to help them to get to where they want to be. And instead, it carries them way away. Any comment or question just here, because I want to talk about where this wind takes them. If you have a comment, or question about it. All right, look if you will then at verse 15. This tempestuous wind called Iroquois tells us that the ship was caught and could not face the wind. We gave way to it and were driven. Which direction is the wind coming from?
Northeast.
All right. And so it takes them. It takes them. What do you do when you're in a wind storm and the wind is trying to take you in a direction you don't want to go? Do you keep your sails up and let the wind just keep pushing you? Well, I'm not a sailor, but it would seem reasonable, at least, that if the wind is taking you away from the direction you want to go, you put the sail down so that it doesn't catch the wind. And that's what they did. And when they put the sails down, the wind just pushed the boat. And so they're out here. Now, have any of you ever been out on the ocean when a storm arose? You have. Hanging over the edge or somewhere, let's say. Yeah.
They had engines.
Yeah. They had engines. They didn't have a sail. Yeah. Maybe you could go in against the wind with an engine.
But just as you pointed out, though, about sorting when there's a storm, when we would be tied up in the Philippines and the typhoon would come, we would go out and meet the typhoon. It's not good for a ship to be tied up.
Yeah.
When a typhoon.
Yeah.
So we go right out.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we have learned just by watching our local news, reporting on typhoons and that sort of thing, in the Philippines, for example, we've seen ships that are way up on where houses are supposed to be. And that's, I guess, the goal, to get them out away from the land where they can stay afloat and not be over along their side, laying on the land. But now we've got a problem. If you're out here and you're trying to do that with sails, you don't have much control of where you're going to direct the thing. And that's what we want to note here. So they just gave way and they're driven by the wind. Verse 16 is rather interesting to me, 16 and 17. It says, "And running under the lee of a small island called Cauda, we were able with difficulty to secure the boat." What does that mean?
Little boat.
Little boat. Okay. All right. Well, we know that we might call those what?
Lifeboats.
Yeah. Okay. So they thought maybe they could secure the lifeboat. So we see about those in verses 30 and 32, and we'll talk about that more when we get to that.
Not
them, yeah, not them, but it. All right, well, notice now in verse 17. It says, "And when they had hoisted it up, they used helps, undergirding the ship, and fearing lest they should be cast upon the Syrtis, they lowered the gear and were so driven." Maybe in our travels in our modern world, we don't build ships like they did. And maybe we don't use the same kind of materials that they did. What were the ships in those days built out of? Built out of wood. Yeah. And they were built out of wood. When you think of a huge ship being cast up and down and up, don't get sick, on the waves of the thing, what's possible to happen to the ship? It could break it. Yeah, just break it right in two. And so one of the things I understand that they did, there's another word that's used, I understand, for this process today called frapping. And what I understand they would do is take heavy cables, and they would work these cables as large as the ship was. Certainly you could see the difficulty in doing that, as it's expressed here. It would be very difficult to take these cables and to walk them back so they would be under the ship. Basically what you're doing is tying the thing together so it won't fall apart out in the sea. And so you're fastening the parts of the ship together, and that's what they're trying to do, lest they should be cast upon Sirtis. Now, what was that?
It was a shallow water ferry off the coast of Libya.
Well, yes, and if you're, I guess the expression I'm looking for is something kind of like being high-centered. Some of you have done some four-wheel driving and that sort of thing. If you get high-centered on a rock, can you picture a ship like that, kind of perched on a sandbar during the time of a tremendous storm? What's it going to do to the ship, and now where?
Well, we'll see that happen at the end of this chapter.
We're going to see, yeah, but we find that they finally make it to this island, which is better than what would be here. Sandbar wouldn't provide them, well, they'd all die.
No escape.
And so if the ship becomes lodged with the sandbar, they're just there. They'll perish. And we find at the end of this chapter, they do make it to this small island. But in verse 17, it said they lowered the gear and were so driven. What we want to know is they take the sails down and they let it go. They've done all they can do. In verse 18, it says, "And as we labored exceedingly with the storm, the next day they began to throw the freight overboard." Now, we've noted that the freight was what?
Wheat.
Wheat. They're getting rid of the cargo of the ship, throwing it overboard. And it says, on the third day, it tells us that they cast out with their own hands the tackling of the ship. Now, if you have a footnote there, it might simply say the furniture of the ship. What are they getting rid of now?
Stuff that helps them take care of the ship while they're in port or sailing.
Yeah, yeah. The necessities to operate the ship, they're getting rid of those things, throwing it overboard. Now, what's the purpose of all of that? Getting rid of the cargo, getting rid of the tackling of the ship? All right, get rid of the weight to make the ship a little bit more buoyant so that they won't have problems with these sandbars and various sundry things that could just hang up the ship and cause the waves then to beat it to death. In verse 20, it says, "And when neither sun nor stars shone upon us for many days, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was now taken away." Been a long time. If you'll note in verse 14, it says, "But the 14th night," when the 14th night was come, they were driven to and fro. Can you imagine this thing, Richard, going on for 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Yeah. Been there, done that, have you? 2 weeks. And they didn't see the stars, they didn't see the sun. For 2 weeks. I can't begin to imagine that kind of thing. But that's what it tells us. They didn't have any hope that they would be saved. Now, here's Paul in verse 21. "And when they had been long without food, then Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, Sirs, ye should have hearkened unto me and not have set sail from Crete and have gotten this injury and loss." Now, if you'll note back over in verse 10, he said, "I know that there's going to be injury and much loss, not only the lading of the ship, but also of our lives." Now, Paul's speaking from his own experience here. He's seen this before. He's endured shipwreck. He knows what that is. Now, when he says, "You should have listened to me," he knows what he's talking about. This is not just an arrogant statement of "I told you so." He's speaking from his own experience. He may not be a shipmaster. He may not be the ship's owner. But he knows what it is to sail on the Mediterranean Sea. And you don't have to be a shipmaster or a ship's owner to know what the sea can do during this awful season of travel. Long without food, Paul said, "You should have listened, not set sail from Crete, and have gotten this injury." Now, verse 22. "And now I exhort you to be of good cheer, for there shall be no loss of life among you, but only the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of God, whose I am, whom also I serve, saying, Fear not, Paul, thou must stand before Caesar. And lo, God hath granted thee all them that sail with thee. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be even so as it hath been spoken unto me. But we must be cast upon a certain island. I want to pause just here and make some observations. Number one, Paul tells them to be of good cheer. You think it'd be a time to be happy now? That'd be kind of difficult, wouldn't it? Be of good cheer. But not because of the experience that you're having. Certainly there's no fun in that. But God has told me that there's not going to be any loss of life. You need to be happy about that. It's not going to be a pleasant experience, but you need to rejoice that you won't die. Now, an angel of God, whose I am, whom also I serve. Evidence, folks, is what Paul has been presenting ever since he has been arrested. Evidence is what he has been presenting ever since he has been converted. Evidence that Jesus is the resurrected Christ. Evidence that his source of information has come from God. Now, here he underscores it again. You think this is the first time these folks on board this ship have heard that? I seriously doubt it too. Yes. An angel of God, whose I am, whom also I serve, said, fear not, Paul, for thou must stand before Caesar. Had God already told him he would go to Rome? Yes. Paul had already expressed his anticipation that he would go to Rome. And now he's going to Rome, and God has assured him that he will stand before Caesar. But not only him, but those whose lives are on board this ship will be spared. Now, in our next study, because you're going to ring that bell on me right here on the concluding note. Right? In our next study, we want to note this expression, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be so even as it hath been spoken unto me. I believe what God said. Now, in your preparation for our class next time, I want you to come up with some reasons why Paul would make such a statement. Why did he believe what God had said? We'll talk about some evidences for his faith. And we'll draw a parallel that his believing God was based upon something of substance. And it resulted in some change of conduct in his life and the lives of these on board this ship. All right? We'll start with that next time then. Thank you.